centre. Stop endlessly scrolling to find your next listen. Let back-to-back sounds do the work. Non-stop listening, however you're feeling. Like the Curious Collection.
Privacy acts as the key barrier between the individual, the society, and the state.
Weekly deep dives into thought-provoking topics.
We're talking about virtual worlds today, how we might live in them, and what they can tell us about what it is to be human.
All in one place.
What if the world that we are already in is imaginary?
Back-to-back sounds. Find it in the podcast tab, only on BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Isabel Wilkerson was born in Washington, D.C. Her parents moved there in the Great Migration when 6 million African Americans left the rural South to escape poor economic conditions and discrimination. Isabel later wrote about this exodus in her best-selling and widely acclaimed book, The Warmth of Other Suns, the product of 15 years of research and more than 1,200 interviews. She started out in newspapers as a reporter and feature writer, and in 1994 she became the first woman of African-American heritage to win the Pulitzer Prize for journalism. More recently, she published her second book, Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents, an examination of racial stratification. The New York Times described it as the keynote non-fiction book of the American century thus far, and it won praise from President Obama, too. Isabel, we're going to hear music by Saint-Saëns, John Coltrane and Philip Glass, but the very first piece you've chosen, I think, is by Telemann.
Yes, it is. It means so much to me because it reflects my mother's dreams for herself and ultimately for me. So growing up, she didn't have access to libraries, for example. She did not have access to the kinds of larger culture that we take for granted. She left Georgia for Washington, D.C. There she met my father, and they married. And when they had me, she, through me, was seeking to manifest all that she had hoped to achieve. So she had many records, and one of them was a record that had a range of classical music. And when I listened to it, I might have been 6 or 7 years old. And this particular piece, it spoke to me. It's like a fairy tale. It's like a music box. It has a lyrical magic to it. It just entranced me.
And I would listen to it. Slightly dance-like feel, too.
It does.
Yeah.
And I found myself wanting to listen to it over and over again. It's very short, and I wished it could have gone longer. I loved it so much as a child.
Rosinante galloping from Telemann's burlesque of Don Quixote. Jeanette Sorrell directed Apollo's Fire. Did it have the young Isabel galloping?
It had my imagination soaring. It had me imagining that I was someplace far, far away, another century, another time.
Growing up in Washington and your mom buying you these LPs must have been a wonderful way of actually exposing a child to culture.
It is, although I had no musical abilities whatsoever, neither did she. She also took me to see musicals, whether it was My Fair Lady, I mean, she took me to those things. She wanted me to have the panoply of exposure. But when I listen to that music, I mean, I just have to smile. I also want to say that, you know, that piece was lost to me for many, many years. I mean, I don't know where the LP ended up. And I didn't know the name of it because I was a child. And several years ago, I heard it on the radio. And then I thought, there it is.
It must have taken a lot of courage for your mom to set up somewhere completely different.
Yeah. The Great Migration that she was part of, you know, began in World War I, and it didn't end until the 1970s. And they were essentially escaping the world that they were born into, which was essentially a caste system known as Jim Crow, where it was actually against the law for a black person and a white person to merely play checkers together in Birmingham. You could go to jail if you were caught doing that. They couldn't dream of going to certain kinds of schools. There were so many restrictions. What you could do for a living was restricted. Every single aspect of life was restricted. And there were consequences that could actually be a danger to anyone who broke the code or the protocols of that world. And so when she left, she had these dreams for herself, as did everyone in that migration.
And your father had been a pilot, hadn't he?
My father had been a Tuskegee Airman.
Having fought in the war, he retrained as an engineer.
He did. After the war, all of those men who were among the finest pilots that the country had produced were prohibited from being able to work as pilots. They were no longer needed at that point. The war was over, and they could not get work. No one would hire them as pilots, so they all had to go back and remake themselves. Some of my father's friends went on to dental school or whatever they chose to do, and my father went back for another degree, and this was in civil engineering. So he became literally the builder of bridges, and I view myself as the daughter of a builder of bridges, and that's one of the things I seek to do in my work.
So the bridges becomes a metaphor as well as an actual thing.
It
Astonishing
does.
To think that you could fight and die for your country, but you couldn't then get a job afterwards.
And it was a loss to everyone. It was also a loss to the country. I say that when we have restrictions on entire groups of people in a society, it hurts the individuals, of course, but it also hurts society itself.
Did you learn a musical instrument when you were growing up?
I attempted to.
Okay, come on, what was it?
You're in the fourth grade and there are choices. Some of my friends chose flute and others chose violin. And for some reason, I think I wanted to just be different from everyone else and I chose a clarinet. I was horrible at the clarinet, absolutely atrocious. There were more squeaks than notes. I have the greatest respect for anyone who can play the clarinet. I know how very difficult it is.
Well, there's a lot of woodwind in the next piece, but primarily there are a lot of pipes as well, aren't there?
Which go into the sinews of the body. I mean, it literally goes into every cell of the body. It's magnificent.
We're talking about the Saint-Saëns organ concerto. Because the organ has pedals, sometimes with 64-foot pipes, the whole area vibrates, doesn't it? You can actually feel your body shaking.
It goes absolutely to the soul.
Well, it's a long piece, so we can't play the whole thing, but let's begin with one of those massive organ chords just to set the scene.
Yeah.
Pulling out all the stops, isn't it?
It has absolutely everything. Cymbals to organ to timpani.
The finale of the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony, where the organist was Olivier Latru, with the French National Orchestra conducted by Christian Massalerou.
It's hard for me to listen to that without tears coming to my eyes. To me, it fulfills Tolstoy's definition of art, that art is the transfer of emotion from one to another. What a beautiful way of describing it. And that piece of music is one of my favorite in the world. It has the beautiful, humble refrain that starts out spare and is pastoral, and then it swells to this triumphant coming together of everything, and to me embodies the hopes and dreams of the people of the Great Migration. And I think about how the people were so humble in their dreams and hopes, again, that humble refrain, that then all coming together in the swell of millions of people and all of those instruments coming together and having that effect. That's what it does for me.
When did you know, Isabel Wilkerson, that you wanted to become a journalist?
I wanted to be a writer. Journalism was the route to becoming a writer. And there's a distinction in that journalism is a particular kind of writing that allows a person who wishes to be a writer to be able to make a living. But underneath it all, I was always seeking to use narrative. Narrative is not often possible in daily journalism. But I've always been that. I've never done anything else. This is all that I've ever done. Writing is just central to me. Obviously, the clarinet was not going to work out for me. So that wasn't going to be possible.
Well, I think we all have to be grateful that you shifted to the writing. And you did very well, because by the age of 30, you were a Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times.
I never considered anything else, so I was able to focus in on this. I was very methodical in my approach to the work because this is all I ever wanted to do.
Would you say you have a formidable determination?
I would say that, as my mother did.
Now, the next music is from the soundtrack of a film, the 1981 Diva. Why yeah. this?
It was the first time that I had seen a depiction on the screen of someone who looked like me, but who was not the stereotype that we've all grown accustomed to, that has been a staple of Hollywood from the beginning. This was a woman who was a renowned opera singer who was, in fact, so acclaimed that a single recording of hers was so valued that people were willing to do almost anything to get a copy of it. And that was the basis of this film.
Hawkins, wasn't it?
Cynthia Hawkins was the singer's name, but the
she was portrayed by the soprano Wilhelmina Fernandez.
Correct, yes. This was the first time I'd seen anything like that. But beyond that, though, the music was haunting. The music was enchanting. The music was transporting. And combined with the visuals, it was something that I'd not seen before nor heard, and it stayed with me.
Thank you.
dramatic. Yes. And a fine voice.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. We heard the aria, Eben, ne andro lontana. Well, then, I shall go far away, from Alfredo Catalani's opera La Vallée, as performed on the soundtrack of the 1981 film Diva, by the soprano Wilhelmina Wiggins-Fernandez, with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Vladimir Kosma. So, Isabel Wilkerson, 1995, and you embarked on what turned out to be a 15-year project, writing a book, an extraordinary book, about the Great Migration called The Warmth of Other Suns. You interviewed a vast number of people, yeah. 1,200, and in the end you focused on three particular people, didn't you? Tell us about them.
Well, one of them was a sharecropper's wife who had been in Mississippi, Ida Mae Gladney, and she and her husband were forced to flee in the 1930s because a relative of theirs had been beaten to within an inch of his life over an accusation which he hadn't even done. He was accused of having stolen some turkeys, and he was nearly killed as a result of that. And so they fled, and they went north to Chicago, following the trajectory, the three streams of migration that people chose to go. And then the second person to leave was a man who had been in Florida working in the citrus groves, and he'd been attempting to organize them for better work conditions and wages. And as a result of that, in the 1940s, it was not acceptable to even rise up and to say anything. He also was forced to flee, and he went to New York following the East Coast migration.
Well, there's a wonderful analogy with birds here somehow, isn't there? You know, birds at migration. And
yes,
these people were going to freedom, in a sense.
In fact, his name was Starling. George Starling was his name.
And then there was another one who was a U.S. Army surgeon.
Yes. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster was a physician, and he had been an outstanding physician in the Army, but when the war ended, yet again, he was not able to get work in a hospital.
Like the pilots.
Absolutely. And so he left Louisiana for California. But as he attempted to do that, he was not permitted to get a room during that long drive. And he had to be very strategic as to how he would maneuver and manage even well past the South. And it was a heartbreaking recognition of how extensive the restrictions were. Even in telling me the story many, many decades later, he found it very difficult to recount it. It was my honor to hear these stories from them because many of them had not even told their own children what they had endured. They didn't want to burden their children. They didn't want to relive the heartache and the post-traumatic stress, you might say, that they'd endured.
Pershing became the personal physician to Ray Charles.
Yes, he did. He himself would have loved to have gone into music.
And I think you feel that what you were doing was telling an undertold story.
Absolutely. 90% of all African Americans were living in the South before the Great Migration began. By the time it was over, nearly half were living all over the rest of the country. And as they migrated out, they brought with them the culture that had been isolated and not heard or seen, creating whole new art forms such as jazz, and also exposing us to people we might not otherwise have known about, such as August Wilson, the playwright, who might not even have existed had there been no Great Migration, kind of like me, his parents wouldn't have met. And so this had a massive, massive impact on the country. Even the idea of red states and blue states kind of grows out of the ways in which people were migrating out.
We're going to hear now a great musician who was part of the migration, indeed, whose life was changed by it. And I think you probably consulted his music, as it were, while you were writing the book. John Coltrane?
John Coltrane is a gift to the world. He was born in North Carolina. His mother migrated first to Philadelphia, and he followed her, and it was there that he got his first alto sax. He then went on to the soprano sax, but that's where he built up this talent that was within him all along, but which could have gone fallow in the Jim Crow South. He practiced all the time. He was virtually obsessed with the saxophone. And there were people who were in the apartment buildings where he lived who were complaining to the landlord, there's this man in 4C or whatever his apartment was who's playing at all hours of the night. And I would suggest that the people who were saying that at the time would never say that now. They would probably say, I lived in the same building as John Coltrane.
Here he is in 1957 playing Blue Train. Thank you. of saxophonist John Coltrane's Blue Train, recorded in September 1957 for the album of the same name. What's it like hearing that again?
I hear the rolling wheels of the train. I hear the exodus of people seeking freedom, seeking to be recognized in their full humanity. We wouldn't know him, we wouldn't know this music, had he not found a way out.
It's hard for us now, perhaps, to conjecture the appalling discrimination that was going on. For example, the fact that people couldn't touch the same Bible in the courtroom.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I describe it as a caste system. It has caste-like characteristics, the idea of purity versus pollution, which is one of the pillars of caste. In courtrooms throughout the South, there was actually a black Bible and an altogether separate white Bible to swear to tell the truth on in court. That means that the same sacred object could not be touched by hands of different races. That means that the very word of God was segregated in the Jim Crow South. That's how extreme it was. That's how far they were willing to take it.
I've often wondered, what are the origins of the term Jim Crow?
Jim Crow itself is taken from a song,
interestingly
enough, from the 19th century, in which a white minstrel singer happened to have seen an enslaved man dancing and singing Jump Jim Crow. This enslaved man who was singing this was actually disabled, and so he was mocking him and doing that. He would be in blackface when he did it. And that's where the term actually comes from, which I think in some ways masks the depth of control and the depth of harm that was done to people.
Because cruelty, because
it sounds somewhat whimsical, and it was not whimsical. This was a brutal regime.
Your book actually has already inspired other artists. I think there was a ballet, wasn't there?
There's a ballet. We're still discovering musicians that are inspired by it.
The ballet, choreographed by Matthew Neenan, inspired the composer Carlos Simon to write this piece of music.
Thank you.
I love the filigree work and sometimes harmonics, which yes. suggest rays of light.
Yes. What I hear is the migratory experience, the whispering, the violin, the whispering among themselves as to what should we do, should we stay or should we go. Every single African-American family in the South would have had to make a decision as to whether to go or whether to stay. And then I hear that leaping into the unknown. And then the mournful departure, because you're leaving all that you've known and you leave those that you had loved, and there's no guarantee that you'll ever see them again.
Well, I'm very grateful to you for introducing us to that. And Carlos Simon, he was born in 1986, African-American composer. Simon is the son of a preacher and grew up in a household where he was forbidden to listen to anything other than gospel music. And he's described gospel's improvisatory nature as a critical influence in the development of his own compositional style. So very nice to find out about a composer and discover them. Your second book, Cast, was published in 2020, and in a way it continues the work you started in The Warmth of Other Suns, how we've inherited a system of caste. And there are some really telling pages, quite awful in a way, comparing what happened in the South to what the Nazis did in Germany.
Yes, it's shocking. I was not expecting to find the connections between the Jim Crow South and the fact that the Nazis had been actually quite fascinated by what the United States had done in the way of jurisprudence to subjugate African Americans. The Nazis actually sent researchers to the United States to study what those Jim Crow laws were as they were devising what would ultimately become the Nuremberg Laws. Now, of course, they did not need to go anywhere to learn how to hate. They were looking for justification and a framework that had been acceptable someplace else that they could then apply to themselves. And they looked at the anti-miscegenation laws. Those are laws that prevented people from different groups, different races, from being able to marry one another. In the United States, there was actually something called the one-drop rule, where if you had one drop of African blood, that meant that you were black. And that was a law that the Nazis felt was too much, had gone too far, shockingly. It's stunning to even say that now.
And you tell a wonderful story in the book, which I think is very revealing, about Martin Luther King visiting Kerala in India and discovering something about himself, to be honest.
Yeah, he'd always wanted to get to India because he'd been so inspired by Mohandas K. Gandhi. And he finally had the chance to go in the winter of 1959, went with his wife, Coretta. And upon arrival, he was greeted as a visiting dignitary because people on the other side of the world recognized him and his leadership. But he wanted to visit with people who were then known as untouchables. Now they are known as Dalits. And he visited a school that was populated by children who were from the Dalit community. And the principal gathered the students around and he said, "Young people, I wish to introduce you to a fellow untouchable from the United States of America." And when Dr. King heard that language applied to him, he first bristled at it. I mean, in fact, he was peeved because he didn't see himself in that way. And then he thought about it. He thought about what was at that moment 20 million black people who were being held outside the body politic, who were prevented from being able to vote, prohibited as to where they could live, where they could go to school, every sphere of life, and that their efforts to be recognized as citizens were being met with tremendous hostility, resentment, and in fact, violence. So he said to himself, "I am an untouchable, and every black person in the United States is an untouchable, too."
We're going to go back and forth here, actually, because we're going to hear a piece 500 years ago, but in a contemporary arrangement. And I think this has a very strong personal reason for you.
Yes, this is music that I only recently came to hear, and it was a concert that my stepdaughter was a part of. And you know, I had many, 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 many losses by that time. My mother had passed, both parents had passed away, my husband had passed away, and here I was at a recital of his daughter. And then this song came on, and I was riveted by it. For one thing, it's bringing together the spiritual components of its origins, but it also was harnessing a more modern, you might even say, sort of African syncopation and percussion that would not be expected. So I felt it was the blend of old and the new, and I was riveted by it.
Come, love the enthusiasm of those young voices.
It just lifts you up.
That arrangement was by Michael Engelhardt and performed in concert in December 2016 by the Angel City Chorale of Los Angeles, conducted by Sue Fink. Throughout Cast, Isabel, you talk about the toll it exerts on different people. It must have been hard to write, and I wonder if you had any music that was particularly important to you at that time.
The music of Philip Glass got me through it. There's something meditative and propulsive about his work. I particularly was drawn to the string quartet number 5. I listened to that over and over again when I was something really, really difficult. Going to the depths of the trauma, I would turn to that.
I know that Philip Glass didn't have to deal with caste issues, but you might like to know that he made a living for many years as a New York cabbie.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that. Well, fortunately, he moved on from that job.
He certainly did. An excerpt from the final movement of Philip Glass's String Quartet No. 5, performed by the Kronos Quartet. I can see how that combination of sort of quiet, contemplative, and then music to get you going.
Well, for one thing, Philip Glass takes you off the planet. I mean, he takes you into another solar system. You've been transported into another dimension deep inside yourself on a bird wing. I perceive him to be telling me what my mother was telling me: you can do whatever you set your mind to. You can do this.
This piece, which you've chosen to finish Debussy's Reverie, Debussy wrote to his publishers, it's an early piece, that he really thought it was a mistake and didn't like it anymore. And so it's just a very good reason why we shouldn't always listen to creative people's first instincts, because sometimes they're wrong. What do you hear in the music that you love?
I hear complexity because that's what I'm listening for. I view the work that I do as bringing many disconnected things together in ways, linking things that people otherwise might not, bringing light to something that is not recognized, that's there, perhaps everyone knows in their bones, but are just not able to see. That's what I view myself as
doing. The very term reverie, which we're going to hear played by Alice Sarah Ott, suggests bringing light in one's dreams almost. So only remains for me, Isabel Wilkerson, to thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Alice Sarah Ott playing Debussy's Reverie. Today's episode of Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael's guest is the musician and writer Ben Watt. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds, and on most smart speakers, just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock and time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. There's heavy fighting in parts of Sudan's capital, Khartoum, as the conflict between armed factions led by two rival generals enters its third week. The army says it's attacking the city from all directions with airstrikes and heavy artillery. Millions of people remain trapped and food is running short. A first plane carrying humanitarian aid from the Red Cross has landed. Its cargo includes surgical supplies. Overnight, Britain ended its operation to fly out UK nationals from an airfield north of Khartoum. The General Secretary of the Royal College of Nursing, Pat Cullen, says there's still time for the government to stop the latest strike by her members. The RCN will walk out from 8 this evening until midnight tomorrow as part of their dispute about pay in England. The Health Secretary, Steve Barclay, said he was disappointed that strike action was being escalated. Ms Cullen said the unions agreed national exemptions for a range of services, including emergency departments and intensive care units. The Transport Secretary, Mark Harper, has accused rail unions of cynically targeting the Eurovision Song Contest Grand Final in Liverpool by calling strikes to coincide with the event. He said the UK was hosting the contest on behalf of Ukraine and showing solidarity with the country should be the priority. The RMT said it had been left with no alternative but to strike. The former Prime Minister Liz Truss is contesting a £12,000 bill relating to her use of a grace and favour home she had when she was Foreign Secretary. The BBC understands she's happy to pay to replace lost items at Chevening House, including bathrobes, but maintains most of the invoice relates to government business. People watching the coronation at home are being invited to join a chorus of millions to swear allegiance to the king during the ceremony next Saturday. The homage of the people will replace the traditional homage of peers. And the weather today, a warm afternoon with showers across parts of the UK, including southern Scotland, the West Midlands and the southwest of England. Top temperatures of 17 degrees Celsius in London, 16 in Belfast, 14 in Edinburgh and 13 in Cardiff. BBC News.
Radio 3 brings you a feast of live music celebrating one of the biggest events of the year, the coronation of Their Majesties King Charles and Queen Camilla. The King has personally chosen music reflecting the four nations and the Commonwealth and commissioned new works to be performed live in Westminster Abbey. Every note of the coronation live across the nation on BBC Radio 3. Join me, Katie Derham, from 10 to 9.